Okay, let's move on. The other really big story is this Russian spy who's been poisoned in Salisbury, Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. Now, the obvious finger of suspicion is pointing at Russia. Do you think it was them?
Well, I think we've got to Maria Zakharova, who is the spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry. What she said the other day is, well, we don't know what's happened here, but there should be an investigation. Nobody should jump to conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, this guy moved in a fairly murky world. You know, he's a double agent. He's, you know, he's been involved in various things. He met his MI6 handler at an industrial espionage conference, apparently, and so on. And, of course, the timing is very, very weird, because the Russians are just about to have a presidential election, which Putin is going to win handsomely. They've got the World Cup coming up. Would they go out of their way to pick on, to kill this guy at a moment like this? The people who would have a motive for doing that are the people that want Russia to look bad. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that's a potential
possibility.
Yeah. And the idea that the Western intelligence services don't engage in this kind of dirty tricks is for the birds. They definitely do.
Yeah.
They bombed Bologna railway station in 1980 and killed 87 people. That's what the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Imposimato, who died not long ago, he wrote a book all about it. They did it.
Mm.
So they're quite prepared to kill large numbers of people, including people on their own side, in order to create this kind of incident.
And
don't forget, we've been bombarded with British generals telling us that they're going to cut off the internet, that they're going to, there's a whole, you know, program of propaganda about the Russians this, the Russians that.
Mm.
I don't think people should jump to conclusions with any incident like this. Terrorist incidents, any incident. The Wiltshire police should be allowed to do a proper job. And I think it's quite significant that they haven't said what the nerve agent used was. And they've been put under pressure, saying, well, why can't you tell us? They're not telling us. And what I suspect is, because you know what's just up the road from Salisbury,
eight miles up
the road.
But, the geographical proximity isn't really significant.
No, it isn't. But the point is, if it's a sort of nerve agent that couldn't possibly have come from Russia, then the finger of suspicion has to point somewhere else, doesn't it?
Yeah, but surely, okay, if it was an internal sting, as it were, whoever was supplying the nerve agent would make sure that it was...
Well, I mean, the other thing I'd point out about this is the Russian intelligence services are pretty professional, and this looks like a pretty sloppy job possible way.
Right,
they haven't killed the targets.
No.
they've poisoned a lot of other people. They've created a lot of massively bad publicity, because they must have, you know, you can imagine if you were a FSB man sitting there thinking, right, we will murder Skripal using this nerve agent. And then, of course, predictably enough, you know, the Western media immediately screams, you know, evil Putin, blah, 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 which is, you know, I mean, what happened with the Litvinenko murder, right, is that polonium, they found the polonium all over the place, which, if you're going to kill somebody, why would you use something that leaves the stuff?
Well, no, because it was the first attempt failed, didn't it?
Well, the point about the polonium was that they found it all over the place, and they found it in Berezovsky's office, who used to be Litvinenko's boss.
Right.
Berezovsky and Putin together, worked to keep Zyuganov from winning the 1998 election in Russia. And what the allegations in the book, Blowing Up Russia, was that bombs had gone off in Moscow and Ryazan, killing hundreds of people in working class tower blocks. The Chechens were blamed. The Russians invaded Chechnya. Yeltsin was re-elected, and Putin was his prime minister. And Berezovsky was deeply involved in all of this. And in the book Blowing Up Russia, which Litvinenko wrote with Felchinsky as his ghostwriter, he said, well, I knew what happened there because I was involved in it. We blew the tower blocks up.
Right.
And Berezovsky was pushing and pushing and pushing for the Western powers to pick up on this stick to beat Putin with. We know he bombed those tower blocks because we did it with him. We know he did it because I was working with him at the time. Berezovsky and Putin fell out.
Yeah. So why didn't the West pick up that stick?
Because the obvious counter move by the Russians is to say, and you did 9/11 and we know all about it.
Right.
So there's a kind of, let's just leave that stuff over there and neither of us dares to use that.
Well,
but people have got to recognise that the intelligence services of the West, and including the Russian intelligence services at that time, were working against the Communist Party. They were working with the West for the oligarchy.
Right.
So in actual fact, it fits the pattern of oligarchic-backed false flag terrorism. It's not a separate thing. Most people don't understand the intricacies of Russian politics. Putin, in fact, double-crossed his backers. The oligarchy brought Putin in because they wanted to keep the communists out,
right,
which Putin successfully did for them. They call them the Siloviki, the securocrats. And then when he'd done that, he turned around to the oligarchy, including Berezovsky, and said, right, you owe me.
Right.
And we're going to make you pay. And Berezovsky fell out with Putin, and then Berezovsky came to the West and became a very feted over here as the man for democracy and so on. But of course, going back to that era of the what I call 999, because all these bombs took place in September 1999.
Right.
So we could call it 999.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just one bomb. But that was a false flag terrorist attack blamed on the Chechens. The Chechens had no motive for bombing working class housing estates in Moscow. They'd won the first Chechen war. They were independent. Dudayev was the president of Chechnya. They were outside the Russian Federation. So they had no... Berezovsky went to talk to Basiev, who was a militant, and he invaded Dagestan at the same time. So the Chechens suddenly start kicking off, bombs go off, and then Boris Yeltsin squeaks home on 50.1% of the vote, with Putin as the Prime Minister.
Right.
And this keeps Zyuganov out, who was the Communist Party candidate. And that's because the oligarchy inside Russia and the Western powers, neither of them wanted to see a communist victory in that election.
Right.
And that's underlying all of this. And Berezovsky, of course, then... The polonium was found by the British police, and it was in some of it was in Berezovsky's office.
Yeah.
And I think that Berezovsky is a far better candidate for killing Litvinenko than anybody else, because he wanted to push the issue of, you know, we've got to get Putin out. He's becoming more and more desperate. He's running out of money. He's an oligarch. He's running out of money.
Right.
He's got loads of British friends, Western friends and so on, but he needs them to push Putin out so he can go back to Russia. And he's quite capable of murdering his own acolyte, Litvinenko, in order to make Putin look bad.
Right.
And of course, Berezovsky then eventually supposedly strangled himself in his bathroom in Surrey. But the local coroner there refused to give a verdict of suicide.
Right, because it's so unlikely.
And I think Berezovsky at that point probably murdered... He's becoming a nuisance to the Western intelligence services, because he keeps pushing this thing of, we've got to go on about the bombings in Moscow. We've got to bring it up. We've got to use it. And they're saying, no, we can't use it, because we're doing that stuff, that we do that stuff, and we were involved in it. In any case, Berezovsky and Litvinenko were both saying, we know that the same intelligence services did this because we were involved in it. Yeah? Mm. Can't people see? Most people have got a very vague idea of all of this history, especially in the West.
Yeah.
And so what you can just... Putin looks like a bad guy from a Bond movie, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Just looks like one. Odd job. And of course, they love... that's what they're pushing. But I think it's the 19th, the election's going to be in Russia.
Yeah.
And I suspect that... Putin will handsomely in the first round. Grudinin will probably come second on about 7%. Zhirinovsky might get 7%. That'll be worrying if Zhirinovsky, who's the far right, beats the communists.
Yeah.
But between them, they will get 14%. The others will get about 5%. Putin will get over 50% in the first round. I'm pretty certain of it. And that's because he's massively... he improved people's living standards.
Right.
Huh? It's a basic thing. He's doubled their wages. We were just talking about British wages not rising He's doubled their wages. He's put them back to work. He's stopped the rot. The place isn't just openly run by gangsters anymore. And also on the things like Ukraine and Syria. Syria less so, because people see that as a kind of, we've got to morally support our side, but they care about. But Ukraine, where 10,000 Russian speakers have been massacred by the Ukrainians, he hasn't got a problem with that. I mean, people are pushing him to take a harder line, and he's just saying, no, we've got to cool it here.
Yeah.
For example, you know, Zhirinovsky would say, well, we should just take the two republics, the Donbass and so on, into the Russian Federation. And Putin's always resisted that, saying, look, if we start doing that, then there's other Russian speakers who are on the other side of the line. Yeah. We've got to think about their future. And we don't want to go around just carving places up. Some deal has got to be done where these two republics stay as part of the Ukraine, but basically run their own show their own way, which is pretty much what the PKK are asking for in Turkey.
Yeah.
And of course, we were talking earlier about these things about countries and what's a country and where a border's drawn.
Well,
and all of this can be managed as long as people are flexible.
But people aren't, because they're sort of, what's the word? They're empire building,
they're not even an empire building. If you're going for a breakaway, you're just trying to get your way. You know,
yeah,
the Kosovans breaking away from Serbia, or the Catalans trying to break out of Spain, or whatever. It's still in the modern world with no capital controls, as we just discussed earlier. Basically, what you're talking about is, what colour flag would you like above the town hall?
Yeah,
it's not actually that, you know, and people, if they think about it rationally, think, well, yes, we do want to have our flag as opposed to somebody else's flag. That's good for our self-esteem. But at the end of the day, calling ourselves an independent country and having a seat at the United Nations is not necessarily the be-all and end-all.
I think
it's Abdullah Öcalan, who's the leader of PKK, who's in prison in Turkey, he actually read Murray Bookchin, who is an American anarchist. And he started to say, well, in actual fact, we don't want to have an independent Kurdistan, but what we do want is autonomy, a lot of cultural rights. We want to be able to speak our own language. Because at one stage, you know, Kurdish was banned as a language in Turkey. You know, it's banned to antagonize people.
Yeah.
And we can settle for half a loaf.
Yeah.
Which is effectively what the Irish Republican movement have done. They've settled for half a loaf.
And indeed, they might actually, I was going to suggest, they might actually end up getting their whole loaf through Brexit, mightn't they?
Well, they would, but I mean, I think some might think like that, but I think there's been an acceptance that the loyalists can't be cajoled into United Ireland against their will.
Right.
And they show no evidence that they've wised up about that. It would be fine if they did. Nobody would care. It would be fine, but they're not going to, because for the reasons we've just said,
yeah,
they want their own flag flying over the town hall and all that self-esteem stuff. But it is going to get very interesting. I mean, Varadkar is the Taoiseach, the PM of Ireland, has called on Sinn Féin to take their seats in the British Parliament, which they don't do, because if they did, then they could vote out the government. So it's a big temptation for them to do that.
Yeah.
But the fact is, Sinn Féin have already said pretty clearly that they won't. Because
right,
the way they operate is they've got a very, you know, they can be flexible on some things, and other things they have to, you know, they're an abstentionist party.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've never taken their seats since 1918 in the British Parliament. But of course, the temptation, if they were more fleet of foot and they could carry their people with them, to just turn up once and vote out the Tory government to smash Brexit might be there.
It might, yeah. And you'd think, I mean, I don't know, it's hard for me as a non-Irish person living in England to gauge the mood of the people, but there might be Sinn Féin supporters in Northern Ireland, and indeed Southern Ireland, who might support them for that sole objective, mightn't they?
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that Sinn Féin have ruled it out because it's too much of a step for their base to take.
Yeah.
And it just confuses people.
Yeah.
They've always said, we're not going to do that. But I think it's something that the Tory government needs to take on board when they talk about negotiating on behalf of Britain and all the rest of it. The DUP need to get their heads around this as well. The majority of people in the six counties in Northern Ireland voted to stay inside the EU.
Yeah.
And that means a substantial chunk of middle-of-the-road opinion voted to stay inside, a Protestant opinion voted to stay inside the EU. Not the majority.
No.
The majority of Protestants voted to leave the EU, but not the majority. Now, we've come down to questions now of what's your mandate to negotiate? Who do you represent?
Yeah. Well, it comes back to that point I was making about these divisions which don't necessarily follow party lines anymore. That's, you know.
Well, I mean, they never did there. I mean, it's not a left-right thing there.
No,
it's to do with, well, it is a left-right thing on one dimension, but on another dimension it's not.
Mm.
I mean, we're hopefully learning in the 21st century to be less dogmatic about this stuff. I mean, in the 19th century, people believed that there was a natural thing called a nation, the Jewish nation, the Irish nation, the English nation, and that each nation had to have a state. Now, of course, that was a recipe for conflict, because in actual fact, throughout most of the world, people are mixed up pretty higgledy-piggledy. And there isn't a separate group of people over here that you can call the English, and a separate group of people over there that you can call the Irish. They live, you know, there's probably loads of Irish people living in Britain and vice versa, you know.
But you mentioned the Kurds, there's another example, and they're spread over three different countries, aren't they?
Well, more than three.
Is it, right?
Yeah.
It's basically three, though, isn't it, I think. Right, let's move on. Let's talk about Italy. The five-star movement has caused a little bit of an upset, haven't they? They're the new political party, and they've basically got the largest share of the vote in the recent election. So what do you make of that?
Well, they are like a kind of, on one level, Beppe Grillo, who set them up, is like a sort of what's his name?
Berlusconi?
Not like Berlusconi. like in this country, like
Farage.
Blair. Not Farage. No.
You'll have to give me a clue.
No, the guy with the beard and the long hair, the hippie.
Lord Bath.
No. you know who I mean. He talked to Miliband before the last election.
In what capacity?
He used to be a comedian.
Okay.
You know who I mean.
Not Bill Bailey.
No, not Bill Bailey.
he used to be a comedian.
Yeah, no, I know. I ought to know this, but it's
you know
my brain is frying here. Russell Brand.
Russell Brand.
Russell Brand, yeah?
Right, okay, yeah.
So
yeah.
Beppe Grillo was like a kind of Russell Brand figure.
Right,
yeah?
right.
So in actual fact, the Grillisti, as they used to be called, but they've now got a new leader, so they can't be called the Grillisti anymore, were kind of lefty populists, if you like.
Okay.
So mostly what they have taken the votes of the Democratic Party that used to be the Communist Party. Yeah?
Right.
So, but they are, they're not...
But they're a right-wing party, aren't they? So.
No. They've taken votes... They're an anti-establishment party.
Okay.
In a Russell Brandish sort of way.
Right. Okay.
And, for example, they call for things like universal basic income.
Okay.
Leave the euro.
Right.
All this sort of stuff.
Okay.
And they were against the establishment. These people have always run Italy, all of them. So what the significance is that Renzi's party, the Democratic Party, which is the Communist Party, which has become totally Blairified, they've lost big style.
Okay.
And the Grillisti, or the five-star people, have taken their votes. What's happened on the right is that Berlusconi's Forza Italia has collapsed, and Lega del Nord has taken the votes. Yeah, because they've changed their name from the Lega del Nord, the Northern League, to the League.
Okay, right.
Yeah,
right.
So that they can
say we're countrywide, with the national
countrywide. But in actual fact, what they used to call for is secession of wealthy areas of Northern Italy from Italy.
Ah, right.
And don't forget that Italy is only a bit of a geographical expression. In actual fact, you know, traditionally it was not, you know, people's loyalty is to their city or their region and not to Italy. You know, despite Garibaldi and all the rest of it, that was all kind of made up at the time, you know.
Yes, it's a relatively recently unified country, isn't it?
Yeah.
Italy? Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know where I read this. I was under the impression that it was looking like a right wing.
No, I think the fact is that the Grillisti are, or let's call them the Five Star Movement, they've picked up votes. Discontented votes from the left and the right, and they're trying to be all things to all people, as these kind of populist kind of parties are. But eventually they're going to have to decide what it is they want. And they see that they're the biggest party, so they ought to form a government. The obvious people from the form a government with would be the remnants of the Democratic Party.
Right.
But if they do that, then they're just part of the system.
Yeah.
And they could form a coalition with the Liga, but they don't want to, because in actual fact, the culture of the two parties is quite separate. The Liga are very anti-immigrant, openly kind of, you know, verging on the Mussolini-ite fascists.
Right.
And the five-star movement is a kind of, you know, led by mums, you know, yummy mummies and so on. You know, they don't want to be associated with that.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting. What will happen is nothing will happen. The eternal roadblock of Italian politics will just continue, because the society's split. This happens all over the world. There's a very strong right wing, and yeah. people who react to that. I mean, look at Brexit here.
Yeah.
Some people are so pro-Brexit that they get up every morning and talk about it, and others just feel alienated by that. They don't necessarily have a strong opinion. They just feel alienated by the right. Yeah.
Mm.
And I think that the five-star voters would not want to go into a coalition with the right.
But they've got to go into coalition with someone, haven't they? Otherwise,
well, unless we're just going to carry on, you know, having nobody running Italy, which
right,
is pretty
right.
much the way it's always been run anyway. And the civil service just gets on with doing things, and everybody carries on rowing, you know.
Yeah. Right then, we are currently entertaining, we in the sense of Great Britain, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, obviously controversial for many reasons related to human rights and so on. How does this all relate to Yemen?
Well, Yemen has been invaded by the Saudis with our support. I mean, British military personnel are directly involved
right.
in what's going on. It's not just that we're kind of at a distance from it.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the RT will obviously pointing out, you know, you go on about Putin being this and Putin being that, and then you've got this absolute thug. He's just wiped out. He's killed loads of people in very recently. He dragged them all in there. They were tortured to death.
Right.
They stole their money. You know, he's a barbarian.
Right.
But he's our barbarian. And we've signed a massive deal with him.
Yeah.
And, of course, underlying all of this is who were the 19 hijackers on 9/11, according to the official story? Oh, they were all from Saudi Arabia, not from Afghanistan or Iraq.
No, that's...
And, of course, after the I think it was the London Bridge attack or the Manchester attack, the Liberal Democrats were still in... No, it must have been before that. The Liberal Democrats were still in coalition with the Tories,
yeah.
and they pushed for an investigation into who was pushing radicalism in Britain. And that report has never been published, because what it shows is that the people funding Wahhabi extremist mosques and so on in Britain are the Saudis. If we're talking about radicalisation of
right,
young Muslims, right. It's the Saudi money which has funded these madrasas all over the world, which pursue a hardline, intolerant brand of Islam, which is not, in fact, mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudis have never been mainstream in terms of... They control Mecca and Medina, which means that they therefore feel as if they are the real Muslims. But in actual fact, their ideology... was invented in the 17th century, and it just came together when the British wanted to create Saudi Arabia in the 1920s,
yeah.
so they could control the oil and all the rest of it. And if you think about it, the oil, in fact, in Saudi Arabia is concentrated in the eastern provinces, which are majority Shia. So if you drew different lines on the border, the Shia should have the oil, and the Sunnis should have the desert.
Right, right.
And of course, that causes fear for the Saudi elite, because if the oil field, which is next to Bahrain, if that became split off from Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
that's the Saudi oil field, yeah.
yeah
but
yeah,
the majority
yeah.
the majority of oil workers in Saudi Arabia are Shia, because of course the Sunni ruling class doesn't work as such.
They certainly don't go
driving trucks around in oil fields.
No. So why is this guy visiting the UK, Mohammed bin Salman?
Well, he's going around the world whipping up support for his regime.
Right.
And his plan with the Israelis to go to war with Iran. That's what they want.
Okay.
And we're
so
being
what end?
Well, because the Iranians, they're just evil and wrong, and they threaten us, and they've got to be stopped.
No, there's got to be more to it than that.
No, they really do feel threatened by the Iranians. They were complaining today about the Iranians and the Turks. They don't like the Turks because they are they're Ottomans rather, you know, they don't speak Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think back to the Lawrence of Arabia time and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that they're basically Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, Erdogan is Muslim Brotherhood. And that's regarded as a threat by the Saudi ruling class, because the Muslim Brotherhood is a mass organisation. Which basically, you know, claims to be representing of Muslims. And, of course, the Saudis see themselves as that.
Right, right.
And The Iranians are a threat because they are Shia and they're a big country with millions of people. Yeah. Saudi Arabia's hardly got a population. More people in Saudi Arabia from outside Saudi Arabia than actual Saudi Arabians.
But surely Saudi Arabia is armed to the teeth with American weaponry.
Well, it is, but nevertheless, they've been trying to crush the Yemenis for some time now with very limited success. Because just as they don't work in oil fields, Saudi princes don't end up on the front line either.
Mm.
They're too busy snorting coke in discos in London.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they've got a real problem there because, the Saudi ruling class basically goes to Lebanon and places like that to have its fun, where they basically indulge in all the things that Western playboy people do, and then they go back to Saudi Arabia to chop people's hands off for
being holier than thou. But given that the ruling classes, and as you're suggesting, enjoy the Western lifestyle, why are they so reluctant to bring it to Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, the spin we're being given on all of this, like in the recent Saudi film about Saudi Arabia, was that this guy's a reformer.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to let women drive cars.
Mm.
He may be killing babies in Yemen with chemical weapons and dropping cluster bombs, but women are going to be allowed. They haven't actually done any driving yet, but
no,
it's going to happen.
Right, right.
Trust us.
Yeah. But is Iran any better on that front? Didn't I read recently about an Iranian woman being sentenced for taking her headscarf off?
Well, in all of these countries, the situation is not as Germaine Greer would like it to be.
Mm.
But there are degrees of all of these things. I mean, in Iran, for example, many women are top scientists and so on.
Right,
it's very much accepted part of, and Iran is basically a modern society. It's got authoritarian tendencies, as some societies have, but they've got reason to be paranoid about people trying to undermine them and mess them around. Don't forget they had their revolution, and immediately the Iraqis invaded with the support of the West to try and crush it. They had to fight a huge war to protect themselves from that. And when that happens, of course, the revolution, Bani Sadr was still in charge when Saddam Hussein invaded, and he was eventually forced out because the war radicalized the situation. And that's what happens with revolutions. It's like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. You have a revolution. It's not just that. All of the previous setup powers come in to try and stop you. And that then pushes the revolution in a more and more extreme direction.
Right.
But of course, in recent years, Rouhani and others, the people who've won the elections in Iran, and they do have elections. When are the elections in Saudi Arabia? Do you remind me? The more moderate people won. Yeah, which is probably what a lot of the people who were protesting were the less, the more extreme faction who were unhappy at losing the election.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the thing about Rouhani is he's also, he cuts subsidies on, things like bread and fuel, which was not in the interests of the poor, but was, as part of normalising his relations with the West.
Mm.
I mean, I think that you've got to see Iran as a society in transition. And, obviously, Tony Gosling, our regular presenter here, he does a lot of stuff for Press TV, which is the Iranian International English Language TV.
Right.
And, if you actually watch Press TV, it was banned by Ofcom from the satellite, but you will see that it's very lively stuff. There's lots of comedy programs, satire programs and stuff like that. You don't get that stuff in Saudi Arabia. It's not an open society.
No.
It's probably the most closed society on earth.
Let's just bring up a couple of other stories. Trump is going to meet Kim Jong-un for peace talks. Is that just pure window dressing and a waste of time?
Well, I mean, I must admit I'm flabbergasted.
Right.
But on the other hand, why not?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Why not? I mean, do you know what my first thought about that was?
Yeah.
Trump will definitely be removed. Because there's been some issue about whether he should be allowed to carry on, even though the deep state doesn't like him and he's not their preferred candidate.
Yeah.
But they probably do not want. You see, Trump could go and do a deal with North Korea and end the bloody war.
But
it's like,
could
oh my
he?
God.
Could he?
Okay. Well, he could in theory.
Well, in theory, if you're talking about the deep state allowing Trump to do things, then surely they might allow or disallow Trump doing a deal with North Korea.
Well, I mean, I think that's It's we could speculate about what may be happening. I mean, something I was reading earlier. So, we're definitely going to war with Iran then. So let's get the North Korean thing pushed off the thing so we can focus on what we're really doing, what the Israelis want and the Saudis want. Well, the Israelis and the Saudis are definitely pushing for Britain and America to go to war with Iran.
Right.
Anybody listening to this program, you should hear what they say. They've not made any secret of it. They want us to go to war with Iran, with them. And we're already engaged in bombing Yemen back into the Stone Age. And, of course, the SAS are still operating inside Syria and so on. Incidentally, coming back to the Russian thing, a Russian general was assassinated in Syria some months ago now, and the Russians said, well, we know that was done with the help of Western intelligence services. That wasn't just a random shot by the rebels. And of course, they then might have a motivation for hitting back, but not by killing some low-level person like this guy in Salisbury.
Yeah.
They should kill a British general if they're going to strike back on that level.
Yeah.
And that's the game we're in, you know. We're engaged in provocations, and we presume that nobody's going to react, or if they do react, then we'll be able to contain it.
I've come up with three separate stories, which I realise are actually the same thing here.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes, so we're...
Fly off at a tangent. This is one that Tony, in his absence, said, you should do this, it's getting zero coverage in the UK, it's massive. And I'm not convinced it is, but let me run it by you. You probably read this.
I glanced at it.
You know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Okay, the Israel Supreme Court has ordered that a former Melbourne school principal wanted over 74 charges relating to allegations of indecent assault and rape against her students be kept in police custody. There was controversy that she was on the verge of being released. Now, okay, a serial alleged child sex offender in Australia... and it was an ultra-Orthodox, presumably Jewish, Israel girls' school in Melbourne. And she's now gone to Australia, to Israel, where perhaps she felt she was safe. I don't know. Is this of relevance to us? Is this a big deal? I mean, it's unpleasant. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I think the fact is I don't know enough about this case to make any strong comments on it. But the idea that the state of Israel looks after its own, wherever they may be... is pretty. I mean, there's a book came out which is much more important, really, recently by an ex-Mossad guy boasting about the 2,500 political assassinations that Mossad has carried out.
Right, right.
You know, they on one level they say, well, we're just a normal democratic country. Hey, look at the 2,500 people we've slotted here. Yeah.
2,500. I mean, if you're a country assassinating people. On every occasion, you've got to make it look like an accident or it's someone else is doing. And you don't really want to get into the habit of doing that.
Well, the thing about Mossad I find rather amusing is that they can't help but boast about their capabilities.
Right, right.
And at the same time, at official level, they deny everything or they say, we just don't comment.
Yeah.
But of course, if you're going to intimidate people, you've got to let them know that you did it. Otherwise, they're not going to be intimidated, are they? I mean, some people, you know, they come home and find a horse's head in their bed and they go, what's this horse's head doing here? Just throw it out of the window, you know.
Yeah, I suppose the key is you intimidate privately, don't you? You don't do it publicly.
Yeah. So there's two audiences.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're becoming very arrogant. I mean, Trump's recognition of Jerusalem and so on.
Yeah.
The US Marines, 2,000 US Marines are in Israel at this moment training for a war with Lebanon, where they're expecting loads of Hezbollah rockets to fly into Israel, so they're training to try and counter that.
Yeah.
I couldn't make it clearer. Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman want a war with Iran. I mean, we've been talking about this for years and years and years now, but they've never faltered on this.
Right.
These people are our allies, and they want us to fight Iran. That's what they're after.
How are they selling it to the UK? Why should we play ball?
Well, in actual fact, I'm glad to say the Foreign Office, by and large, just pours cold water on it.
Okay.
It's like, you know, we don't really want to do that because it's a bit unpredictable.
Yeah.
But don't forget that the thing is being pushed in a certain direction. I mean, Britain didn't go along with Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Well, no other country did, I believe.
Guatemala.
Oh, did they?
Now
oh,
done
right,
so.
Right, right.
Although in Guatemala, you've got a government that came to power through a military coup backed by the Americans
yeah,
and it's not accepted by the population. In fact, hundreds of people have been killed by the government of Guatemala. And of course, in the 1980s, it was a true killing field orchestrated by the CIA.
Right, right. The Russian army in Damascus... We'll have to wait for another day, Martin, but we've talked about that before,
yeah.
And we will no doubt talk about it again, but we're almost out of time. But thank you very much for your time today. Tony Gosling is going to be back in this hot seat in 1 week's time, we hope, we assume.
Yeah.
Have you heard from him at all? Is he actually,
yes, well, I've heard a couple of things. I mean, he's on his way back. As far
yeah,
as I know.
And hopefully, I believe he does listen in his absence, because we're on the winter webs and stuff, and so you can tune in.
Can I say that the non-BCFM... thisweek.org.uk or BCFM's website, you will find this show.
Lovely. Thank you, Martin. Tony's back next week, and I'm on your radio tomorrow morning helping out with the art show. She's got too much of me this week. What's going on?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.